Hello and welcome to Pints with Treebeard. My name is Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho. And today I'm joined by the man of the hour, the Tower of Power, too sweet to be sour, Jameson Winter.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction. My name is Jameson Winter. I am the dean of the upper school at Augustine School in Jackson, Tennessee. Josh, what are we talking about today?
So we're continuing talking about reading to children broadly. So last time we talked about, we tried to make the case that you should read to your children. You should read out loud to your children. You should select good stories and take them through good stories or mediocre stories and explain why they're mediocre. Don't read bad stories to your kids. There's only so many hours in the day. Today, we're going to focus on a subset of that, which is particularly reading to your young children and particularly reading picture books. And our hope today is to just mostly talk specific examples. So we've prepared lists of kind of our favorites, the tried and true titles that we have loved, that, you know, in my family at least, the ones that we've read the covers off and have replaced, right? And some of these were on round three. So that's the focus of today. We're not trying to make the case why you should read picture books to your children. We're arguing what sort of picture books you should read to your children. But before that, maybe we should address what sort of picture books you shouldn't read to your children. So Jameson, if you were to give just thoughts on what to avoid, like what are the things you shouldn't put in front of your kids?
The first that comes to mind is what we were talking about before the show, which is just that you can't trust awards that are given to books. Sometimes awards are given to great books and you should read them and they deserve the award. But the fact of the matter is that we live in a culture that doesn't know what a good story is and that can't assess what is true, good, or beautiful. And so you just can't trust those things blindly. If somebody makes you a recommendation, hey, this won some award or something like that, investigate it, but investigate it with an eye that understands that what the elites love and are drawn to is not necessarily what God loves, particularly in our culture.
Well, at the same time, recognizing that they do have a certain level of technical prowess and they can assess excellence in one area. So, you know, particularly for ours today, if you look at the Caldecott winners, in the vast majority of cases, there is technical excellence. It's well constructed. It's just not necessarily tied to a story about what's good, true, or beautiful. Their loves, as you say, their loves are not rightly ordered, even if their technical ability to assess, you know, competent art or competent style is good.
Yes, and that's actually one of the things that makes it dangerous, right? Because it can very easily subvert your intuition where you see these beautiful pictures or you understand this as actually, it has some coherence as a story and I don't mind reading it out loud. They have a kind of ear for the cadence that you need to have reading a children's book. That just means you need to be wary, right? You need to be on your guard. And that's true always, not just with award-winning books. That's true with any book. So maybe some specific things to watch out for quickly, and then we can go into some good books. I was talking to my wife and my mother-in-law about this, and my mother-in-law said that she really has a distaste for Disney books or animated movie retellings because
Amen.
They're just like dumbed down. And they're not even the real story, even if it is a good story. They're not the real story. They're not deep. They can't really translate into a 20-page picture book very well. And they're just banal. They're boring and not fun to read. So that's kind of tied to a second thing, which is books that are very low vocabulary and always short, choppy sentences that are thinking far too little of a child's ability to understand and that aren't stretching them. We talked about that last week, right? That you want to be actually stretching your children and giving them new vocabulary and helping them understand, even if they don't get everything, what some of these words mean or how these complex sentences work together. That's how they learn. A couple of other things just to pay attention to in no certain order. We have a really pretty strict policy on disrespectful or disobedient children in stories, and specifically when they're getting away with it, right? So there's a difference in something like Sir Battalot, where he's fussy and complainy, and that's the whole point, is that he actually learns to overcome and rule his spirit, and that's the purpose of the book, versus Llama Llama Red Pajama, which is like 90% great, and then there's this one page in the middle where he's just stomping and hollering and yelling and getting angry. And you get a little bit of that correction from his mom when she comes up into the room. So we still actually read portions of that book. We just always skip a couple pages. She's teaching him not to fuss. She's right downstairs. And that's a good picture to paint for your kids. Like, look, when you're upset in bed, mom's right outside. She's still in the house, right? We're not leaving you. So there's maybe something there, but we honestly don't read it that much. If we do, you know, we edit, we skip a couple of pages.
That brings up a really interesting point. Like, do you edit books, and to what extent do you edit books, and why? Like, particularly the picture books. We love Llama Llama Red Pajama, except for, yeah, the rhyme scheme on that one always makes me.
Yeah.
Llama Llama Red Pajama, but we never say pajamas, but you don't say Llama Llama Red Pajama. Like, that wouldn't work at all. So we actually do read the whole thing, and just every time use it as an example. Like, should Llama Llama be doing that?
Right.
No, he shouldn't.
Yes.
He is being preposterous right now.
That's right.
Yeah.
Preposterous is a good word to teach them in a book that doesn't have large vocabulary words.
But there's another instance where I totally edit, and that is we got this one edition of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe that's just horrible. Like, it's a picture book of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The illustrations are great, and the text is horrible. And if I ever read it, I will absolutely edit it because I want to do justice to the original. And I'm like, this is not... It'd be one thing if I was using it as a negative example, but like, no, this is just not true to the story that is real.
Yeah. And you don't want to make a great book that's been shortened a bad example for your kids. You want them to look forward to reading the great book. So that makes sense. Have you, just out of curiosity, I've never done this, but I've thought about it. Have you ever gone in and like Sharpied out some of the words and rewritten in your own notes?
I never have. No. I think if there's a book that I objected to that strongly, I just chuck it. So I've never found one that's good enough for me to keep, but bad enough for me to alter.
Yeah. I haven't done it either for that reason, but I've thought about it a couple of times and thought, I'll just either keep editing or toss it. And that's the thing that I would say is just if there's something you need to edit and it's cumbersome, like Llama Llama Red Pajama, literally, we just skip a couple of pages. And I think explaining it to your kids every time is fine. You just have to be diligent to do that. But if it's getting more complex than that, I would just move on. Cause like we said last week, and like we're about to see, there are tons of great books.
There's so many good books.
A couple of other things stylistically that are maybe less moral, but still moral in a way, and that form your child's heart and mind and imagination, are just bad or grotesque artwork. Grotesque artwork particularly seems to be celebrated these days in award-winning books. There's artwork that's just intentionally bad, so to speak, stylistically. That's a maybe simple term to describe it, and they would probably have much more, you know, thoughtful or provocative words to describe what they're trying to accomplish in the mind of a, you know, 3-year-old. But on the surface, it just doesn't look great. And so being aware of that, because the kinds of books that you read teach your kids what kinds of pictures to look at and what kinds of pictures are good and beautiful and lovely. And then the same thing I would say of the words, which is that if a book has bad verse or bad prose that's not good to read aloud, then it's, you're going to be working against it. It's not that you can't overcome that as a reader, but it's going to be a lot harder to overcome. And you're not going to look forward to reading it if it's not a good rhyme scheme, not a good cadence, not a good rhythm. Even in the prose, if it's not rhyming, if it's just written in prose, it needs to have the kind of construction that lends itself to being read aloud.
A lot of this just falls under the advice we gave last week, which is you should read the things to your kids that you love and that you like to read and that you think are lovely. And if you're reading it and you're just thinking, this is boring as all get out, and there's no good artwork. This is just, like, really, if you're reading it and thinking, this is bad, I don't like this, well, then you're just condescending to your children because you're giving them something that you don't think is worthwhile, and you're not going to want to do it, and they're going to sense that you don't want to do it. And so if you get nothing else out of this one for today, just chuck the books that you don't like and find ones that you do. There's so many good books.
Well, on that note, unless you have anything else to say about bad books, what's your first good book that you have? Because I think we should just get into it here. We've got a bunch of books on both of our lists to try to get through.
Yeah, let's do it. So these will be in sort of no particular order, maybe with the heading of the books you present your very young children are telling them what the world is. And so that's where this all fits. So some of the books that I'm going to recommend don't have particularly strong narratives, but they are presenting a world that I want my children to see because I think it's true. And so it's maybe more along the lines of a nature hike than it is necessarily an arc of redemption. But nature hikes are good too. So for my first one, you have Bear Snores On, which is a board book. And it is one of my favorites for the board book genre. The illustrations are pleasing. They're lovely. It's all forest, woodland creatures. The premise of the narrative is that a bear is asleep in his den, and it's a big stormy night, and all the other animals one by one come into his cave, and they start just having a party, and then eventually the bear wakes up and is sad that he wasn't that he's missed out. And then the other animals invite him in, and they have just a big party in his den. The narrative is not what I love about it. What I love about it is the rhyme scheme, actually, and the meter and the rhythm to it. Because when you've read enough Dr. Seuss, or you've read enough books that attempt to rhyme, Dr. Seuss is great.
Sometimes.
You're right. It's actually really hard to have a good, effective rhyme scheme. And so. This one, I've read it enough times, I think I can give you most of it, but I'll give you a bit. It begins like, in a cave in the woods, in his deep dark lair, through the long cold winter sleeps a great brown bear. Cuddled in a heap, with his eyes shut tight, he sleeps through the day, he sleeps through the night. And like, that's this, it's got this lovely rolling rhythm to it. The words interweave in a delightful fashion. It's consistent throughout, and it's presenting them... It's presenting children with just delightful words. And so I love reading it because I love words. And I want my children to love words too. And I want them to have words they can taste and they can kind of that roll off the tongue. And I want them to know how words work. And so presenting it, they're too young for Shakespeare. So I present them with Bear Snores On. So Bear Snores On, that's my first one. I commend it to you.
My first, I'm actually going to go ahead and go off script and change just because you brought up a board book. I'll go with another board book, which is Goodnight, Goodnight Construction Site. We love this one. It similarly has a good rhyme scheme, maybe not quite as strong as what you were just quoting, but still good. In terms of what you can see in a board book and what you can experience in that genre, I would hold it up above most of the ones that we have. It's pleasing to read. But the biggest thing that we love about it is actually the artwork. So it's just well drawn and full of colorful and kind of nuanced drawings. It looks like maybe kind of a colored pencil almost drawing, and there's lots of good shading and things like this that just make the pictures intricate rather than just kind of the bland, here are your basic primary and secondary colors pasted onto a book and mass produced. It's actually got quite a bit of skill that goes into the illustrations. And it's just fun to watch dump trucks and, excavators and steamrollers and cranes tucking in their little cranes and little dump trucks and all of these things. And it's just, I think it's clever. It's whimsical. And we have two boys as our oldest. So who doesn't love dump trucks and cranes and things like that at that age?
No, I think that's great. I actually haven't read that one, but I've just been looking at it just now. And I see what you mean about the artwork. It's got what so many good children's books ought to have, which is this mix of the whimsical and the realistic.
Yes.
So let me present you the world, but let me present it to the world on your level. And not condescending, but I don't have to give you the uber realistic pictures. I can give you the sense of the thing in a way that's accessible to you and in a way that's lovely. And that's great.
I saw you looking it up, and I'm going to go ahead and do this, and I'll say it in the show so that I have to finish the process. I'm going to go ahead and create a list of these, like an Amazon list, and maybe we can put them in the show notes that way, just in case people want to go and look at them and investigate them for themselves. So what's your next book? What do you have next?
Yeah, so you mentioned that you have two boys, and so that looks like a great boy book. So I'll be providing more of the girl books, perhaps. But pound for pound, one of the tops on our list is Miss Susie. Miss Susie, which the author escapes me, but it's illustrated by Arnold Lobel, who also will appear elsewhere on my list. But Miss Susie is the illustration is going to be great if it's Arnold Lobel. But it's the story of a little gray squirrel who has a lovely home in the top of an oak tree and loves to bake and loves to keep clean and keep house. And she just has a wonderful, peaceful little life. And then six nasty red squirrels come in and they chase her out of her home and they ruin everything. And she has to go and find a new place to live. She goes and she finds a attic. The attic has a doll's house. Then she goes out looking for something to eat. She uncovers a box of toy soldiers. And so she decides, well, I'll take in these toy soldiers. They'll come into the doll's house and I'll make a home for them. And so she becomes, you know, a mother to these toy soldiers, and she cooks and cleans and helps them. And it's this wonderful picture of her being, undaunted in the midst of difficulty and making do with what she has and being domestic. And then eventually she tells them the story of the red squirrels who chased her out of her home. And the soldiers say, like, well, we're going to handle that. And so then the soldiers all march out and they go back to her home and they clear out the red squirrels. And then they invite Miss Susie back to her house. So it's this lovely, like, it's got both the masculine and the feminine, right? It's got the feminine, presenting domesticity as a thing that's lovely, but also the courage and tenacity that it takes to keep your cool in the midst of difficulty. And to be, you know, to be a faithful mother to these wayward, you know, these homeless soldiers. But then the courage of the soldiers, and the way they're described as, you know, there's only five of them, but their hearts were brave and they have their swords and they clear out the ruffians. So this, the picture of the ruffians versus the men under authority, is wonderful. So Miss Susie, a good choice.
Great. I want to add one more board book in here that I didn't plan on.
Do it, man.
And I might come back to one other one later, if we have time. But one that I recommend, not because of the story or because of the artwork even, because I'll whisper this quietly, I don't really love the artwork in Eric Carle's books.
I don't either. It's okay.
But I do like Brown Bear, Brown Bear a lot, and it's for a very specific reason.
Except for Brown Bear, Brown Bear. Yeah. And Brown Bear, Brown Bear is great.
The reason that I like this book is because I read each page in what I take to be the voice of that animal. And it's a lot of fun.
Yes,
and doing a goldfish and reading it like you're underwater is one of the funniest things for kids that I've been able to do so far. So I commend Brown Bear, Brown Bear if, and maybe only if, you're going to read it in the voices of the animals.
Very good. Yes, agreed. My next one is a Mother Goose treasury. I think the Mother Goose treasuries, you almost can't go wrong. We've seen, I don't know, we probably have a dozen different Mother Goose compilations, and they're pretty much all great. And again, what are you doing here? You're not giving them narratives. I mean, there are very small narratives, but you're presenting them with, they're almost proverbs. They're almost fables in a really small, bite-sized way that's easy to remember. And so many of them, you just treat them as if they're just fun, meaningless little ditties. And then you go, actually, no, that's true. And let me explain to you how true this is and what it's getting at. Our favorite compilation is Sylvia Long's, which is just, yeah. That's our favorite. She takes it's all animals, which, you know, you have various schools of thought on that. I think that the ones that are animals are particularly lovely for children. And you dodge there's a lot of artistic things you don't have to decide if you make them all animals. And what she's done, which is really nice, is she's, in a given spread. So in a given two page setup, she's paired some of the rhymes that go together and have there be like continuity between the two. Silly example, but she's got, there once was a girl who had a little curl right in the middle of her forehead. When she was good, she was very, very good. When she was bad, she was horrid. And that's on one page. And the other page is curly locks, wilt thou be mine. And it's the same characters there. So providing a little bit more continuity, which is what Mother Goose often lacks. And so you have this sort of, it's more than just little ditties on a page, but okay, there's a little bit of a story here that I can interpret for you. So Sylvia Long's Mother Goose, very, very good.
My next one would be, I'm going to go ahead and say it now, the board book from earlier. It's really more of the author and anything that she's done, which is we really love the Sandra Boynton board books.
Oh, good, good, good. Thank you.
Yeah, yes. Barnyard Dance, Pajama Time, Moo Ba, La La La. There's so many. I mean, we have probably half a dozen at least, but Not the Hippopotamus is a great one. Too many to recommend. Really, just anything by her is great. And there are actually accompanying songs to these, which means we listen to those in the car. So they're just fantastic. I think we've read those enough, and they're board books, so this happens, that they've been chewed on, they've been torn apart, and we've bought multiple copies of more than one of them, which when you're buying multiple copies of a book, you know you're using it a lot. And even the ones we bought most recently are not in great condition just because we go through them so much. And you go through them with little kids, so you know they're not going to stand up very long. But yeah, anything by Sandra Boynton we have loved. I haven't found one.
Yeah, Sandra Boynton's one that I had to come around on. I think her artwork, the style of it, I was just a fuddy-duddy, basically, at first. And so I had to come around on Sandra Boynton, but I've come thoroughly around. Yeah, 100%.
Yes, it's very kind of the opposite of Goodnight, Goodnight Construction Site. It's very simplistic, very plain, and not much complexity going on in the artwork. We just find them fun to read. They're cheerful, they're delightful, they're whimsical. And I understand that maybe hesitation with the artwork, but I commend them.
Yeah, no, they're bouncy and fun. Okay, well, let's take a sharply different turn. My next one is pound for pound, maybe the one I have spent the most time with. And I think we are on our third, but this is Dangerous Journey. And I actually can't find the author because Dangerous Journey is just selections from Pilgrim's Progress put to incredible illustrations. So it's just the text of Pilgrim's Progress, but chopped up so that it fits in a single, you know, kid's book. And so there's so much to love about Dangerous Journey. Like I said, we've read the cover off it twice. It's divided up into 10 chapters. The first 9 are Christian's journey. The 10th one is Christiana's. So you can read one chapter, and that's about the length of a medium length picture book. So it's like 10 picture books really, but you can read it in the same way you would read, one of these others, like A Frog and Toad or something. But the illustrations are, first of all, magnificent. Second of all, they're terrifying, I think is the word. He does not shy away from the frightening. You were talking earlier, Jameson, about grotesque. It's not grotesque. It's frightening. It's fearsome. Like the spread where Apollyon is over Christian and is like fires coming out of his belly and he's this terrifying dragon and Christian's doomed. Like, yeah, it was scary. But it's true. Like, it's presenting the world truly. So the whole thing is coherent and is coherent to the real world. And so, sure, the pictures of Apollyon are terrifying, but the pictures of the Celestial City are amazing. And so it gives and gives and gives. Yeah, pound for pound, hard to beat Dangerous Journey for my money. And then the fact that you're giving them Bunyan's actual prose means there's going to be unfamiliar words, which you have to then explain, which is valuable in itself. And then they're actually getting, you know, some of the most compelling writing like of the modern age, you know, in the last 500 years. So you're actually giving it to them undiluted. So Dangerous Journey. Very, very good.
That's excellent. I didn't actually know about this. So I'm adding it to the list and maybe double check with me when I send it to you that it's the correct one. But it looks like it's maybe the correct one. And that's excellent that they would put this into a children's book with Bunyan's actual words. That's phenomenal. So my next one would be Brambley Hedge. There are more of these. I only have the classic collection, so there are maybe 8 to 10 stories in that, but there are other books and other collections of these stories that kind of mix and match in different ways. I can recommend all of them in the classic collection because I've read them. I'm pretty sure I can recommend all the others as well. So these are by Jill Barklum. They are very British. It's about a little kind of colony of mice that live in the countryside in England, and they have these amazing illustrations. I mean, they they show you the inside of these tree stumps that they all live in. They live in various kinds of stumps, and there's the king and the queen who live in the palace, and then there's the miller who lives in the flour mill. And it's amazing to see all of the intricate little details that she weaves into these illustrations, because it's just one of those picture books that you would hold as a kid and you would look at for 10 minutes, the same picture, trying to find new things in it that you hadn't really looked at before. And you're trying to see, like, oh, how does this butter churn work? And like, where do all of these wheels go throughout the stump? And let me follow this rubber band all the way up to the pulley system and everything like that, right? It's so phenomenal. But then the stories are good too. And they're not tales like Aesop or something, even, you know, any version of the Pilgrim's Progress, where there are these deep moral lessons that she's trying to teach. They're just good stories. They're stories about weddings and stories about having children and stories about going sailing. And it's just kind of everyday life. Like you said, I love the analogy of it being a walk in the woods rather than something more, you know, more meticulous or focused on this principle or this idea that we're trying to communicate to kids, because those are great and they have their place, but there's also a place for stories that are just fun to read and they're just well told. So yeah, Brambley Hedge, we have the classic collection, but I'm sure any of them would be phenomenal.
That's a great reminder. My grandparents had Brambley Hedge books, and I remember poring over them. That's one that we've missed. So we need to rectify that. My next one is actually the only one on my list I think is not a picture book. And that is the poems of A.A. Milne. So particularly I have When We Were Very Young and Now We Are Six in one volume. Those are separate volumes, but we tried Winnie the Pooh, and call me fussy or something, but I actually had a hard time reading Winnie the Pooh because it was too painful because he does such a great job of skewering vice. And I just found, like, all of these characters are sinning, but they're sinning in such predictable and true and human ways. And, like, it got me. And so maybe I need to pick up Winnie the Pooh again and give those to my kids. But I was like, I thought this would be just a fun romp and more like the Disney movies. And this is more like Jane Austen or something. Like, it's getting me. But we have had we've gotten tremendous mileage out of his poems. And I'm a huge advocate for giving your kids poetry. For a variety of reasons. One, because you want them to love words. You want them to be people who love words. You want them to be children and ultimately adults who can use words well. And so you want them to teach them at a young age that words are a thing that we just love for themselves. And then we'll figure out how to put them together and use them to accomplish purposes. But for right now, I mean, just the fact that we have a whimsical verse that's well executed and uses words well, that's just money in the bank. But then also, we live in a poetic world. We live in a world that should be interpreted poetically. So much of the scriptures are poetry. And so, as you're teaching your children how to read and how to love poetry, you're just equipping them to read the scriptures and to read the world better. And I cannot think of a better place to begin than A.A. Milne. Other than Mother Goose. So once you've gone Mother Goose, you go A.A. Milne next. Our top favorite by far is The King's Breakfast. And so if you do nothing else today, then look up The King's Breakfast by A.A. Milne. I will have done you a good deed.
I think you're right that poetry is so essential, and it just sticks in the mind. And like you said, teaches you how to view the world in a different kind of way. And maybe particularly for our modern scientific age or postmodern scientific age, if you want to say that, where we want to quantify everything, we want to touch everything, we want to put it in boxes with labels and sort everything and not let the vegetables touch. Poetry kind of cuts against that mindset in a way that's very edifying and good for us. So my next book is actually a book that was given to me by a former student of mine for our boys, which is James Herriot's Treasury for Children. So this is the author of All Creatures Great and Small, and there are two or three others, I think, in the series.
All Things Bright and Beautiful, I think.
Yeah, All Things Wise and Wonderful. And so he is a veterinarian in England, kind of walking the countryside or driving the countryside to these different, you know, farms and households with people's pets or horses or cattle or whatever, and just has fascinating stories. I mean, these are thick volumes for adults. So they've taken that and condensed, I think, again, his own words. It's been edited down and shortened so that you read one and it takes you 10 to 15 minutes. So they're not, you know, 5 minute reads, but they're one story, following one story of this animal and this kind of event that happened in his life. And they do a great job of condensing it. You can tell there's maybe more here that he might have written about in the full book, but it doesn't feel like, oh, there's this gap in the story and something doesn't make sense or I don't get it. You know, they maybe skip a couple of weeks and they tell you that, you know, 2 weeks later this happened or whatever. So it's just a really well, I think, edited edition of his stories, which are delightful to read in general. But then the illustrations are just incredible. So it's illustrated by Ruth Brown and Peter Barrett. I don't know anything else by them, but I know that this is phenomenal work. And the boys, again, just love to read this book and look at the pictures and see the animals. They're very realistically done. It's not whimsical. It's not silly in any way. They're taking the illustrations very seriously. And that's good because these are serious stories. Again, they're not, you know, these moral tales necessarily, although you can learn some wisdom from some of them, certainly. They're fun. They're enjoyable. They captivate the imagination of kids. And yet they're taking that very seriously. It's not being treated flippantly, which I appreciate.
Yeah, those are great. We've got a few, and I remember fondly my dad reading those to us when I was a kid. Maybe following in that similar vein, this is one that a friend gave me a few years ago that I hadn't encountered before, but this is called All the Places to Love. And again, I actually don't remember the author's name, but it's a the artwork is very similar to what you're describing in James Herriot. Presenting it extremely realistically, but beautifully, I think it's, you know, oil on canvas or something like that. And it's the story of, well, it's not even really a story. It's a young boy walking the reader through all of the places that he loves, and all of the, but every place is tied to a relationship. So the setup of the story is that he's just, his baby sister has just been born, and so or is about to be born, and he's kind of showing the reader his world. And so he'll go to the barn, and he's like, this is my grandfather's barn, and when I was born, my grandfather carved my name on that beam, and my grandfather loves this place. Now let's go to the hill, like Windy Hill, where my mother says you can reach up and touch the sky. And, you know, this is her place. And then we go to the farm where it's, you know, the picture is him lying on the ground with his dad, like with their hands in the dirt. And he says, you know, my dad says this is good dirt. And it's a wonderful picture of what it looks like to be bound to a place and to love your place because you love the people who have poured themselves into it. And then at the end of the story, his sister is born. And the last spread is him, you know, taking his sister, his little toddler sister, to his favorite place, and like now you're part of this thing. So the artwork is breathtaking because it manages to capture both the relationship that the little boy has with each person in his family, and also just the beauty of the place. And so it ideally makes you love your place and makes you love your people. And say, okay, what are my places?
That sounds amazing. And I'm just looking at pictures of it. And you're right, those images are gorgeous. They are, it looks like, yeah, oil on canvas or something. It's clearly painted. It's not just illustrated. It's not just drawn. So that's fantastic. That's one that I want us to maybe look into for a Christmas or a birthday gift coming up. My next one is maybe similar, if you want to think about the theme of home, which is The Wizard of Oz. So there's an edited version. Of course, The Wizard of Oz is fantastic as it is, but there's an edited version that, again, takes Frank Baum's story and condenses it. So it's still his words. It's just abridged. And then it's illustrated by Charles, I think, Santore. And the illustrations are breathtaking. They're full pages the whole time. And it takes, I mean, you can't read this in one sitting. It would take you many sittings to get through it, but it is still, it's still doable. You know, we'll maybe take it in five or six, seven passes sometimes, depending on how long we're sitting and reading. But yeah, I mean, it's just such a good introduction to the story. We've listened to it in the car, the whole thing in the car, so the boys know the story. But when we're reading it, you know, because there's pictures on every page and it's the full page artwork and everything, they just get engrossed in it and they can understand more of what's happening. So you've got all kinds of themes. You've got the theme of getting back home. You've got the theme of helping those in need and finding the strengths and the weaknesses of others, and the lion and the tin man and the scarecrow. And there are so many themes. I mean, this story, I watched the movie growing up. I haven't read the book except for maybe once in its fullness. And then this edited edition. So it's still a new story to me in some sense. And it's so rich, but you've got obviously the conflict with the witches and overcoming evil, the standing in the face of tyranny and destruction and death. I mean, because the movie, I didn't realize this until we went through the whole book on a trip to Florida, the movie skips over so many important details of the wicked witches kind of oppression of Dorothy and the others. And like, she's enslaved for a time. And, you know, the Tin Man is all broken up and the lion is being tormented day and night. And the scarecrow has his stuffing ripped out and all of these things, right? But you see her and the others overcome those things. It's a fantastic story. And then this is just a particularly beautiful edition.
That's another one my grandparents had that I remember. Yeah, lovely. I think my next one will be maybe in a similar vein artistically. I guess I'm following you artistically, but not thematically. So this is Graham Bass's Animalia, which Graham Bass's stuff are all gorgeously illustrated and extremely intricately illustrated. So the first one that I encountered of his was The 11th Hour, which is a sprawling, rhyming mystery, but it's a look and find book almost. So on every book, on every page, there's hidden clues, and you're trying to figure out who stole the feast. And so The 11th Hour is wonderful. The one that we've done even more, though, for our kids is Animalia, which is an A to Z, where every page is a letter and an animal. But then there's, in some cases, literally hundreds, in other cases, only dozens, but of objects or ideas or things that are hidden in the page with that correspond to that letter. You know, so you have the alligator and you have the antelope and you have the armadillo and the abacus and you keep on going. You're like, wait a second, what's that? Well, it's got to be an A. Well, oh, it's an astronaut, of course. And so it's this puzzle. You're trying to see the things and trying to figure out how they relate to the letter in question. And so I think it's lovely. It's not one that you sit and read with your kids. It's one that you sit and pour over with your kids and you're trying to figure it out together. And again, what's the virtue there? Why present your children with this? Well, it's showing them, first of all, just lovely illustration. Like they're well executed, they're well done, but it's just this romp, and some pages more than others, but it's just this decadent, overflowing abundance of creation sort of thing. Maybe my favorite page is the P page. There's this parade, and you're like, there's a pirate and a pope and a politician and a prince and a princess, and they're just all parading by with peacocks and pandas, and it's just extravagant and wonderful. So that's the world God made for you, and you should delight in it with your kids.
I've not heard of those, and I'm just looking at the covers now as I add them to the list, and I can see what you mean already with the 11th Hour, particularly looking at that cover, just how detailed, how many little things must be there. So I'll go back to one that's earlier on my list that I skipped over, which is Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel. This is a
Mike Mulligan,
Virginia Lee Burton book. So we have this, and we also have The Little House, which is her Caldecott Award winner. And maybe one of hers. Maybe she has more than one. I'm not sure. But she's well known to the world and not to me until recently. My wife introduced me to these books and she had them growing up, I think. So they're just both phenomenal. The Little House is great because it's a house that's built by a man that he says our great-great-grandchildren's great-great-grandchildren will live in this house and it'll never be sold for gold or silver. And, you know, it's out in the countryside and there are apple trees and a creek and a watering hole where the kids play. And the little house gets to watch the seasons go by. And then slowly but surely the city encroaches in the background. And she starts off by dreaming about living in the city or being part of the city as this little house. And it consumes her, essentially. You see, you know, her windows are broken. She goes into disrepair. Nobody's living there. It ends with the, you know, great, 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 great granddaughter of the man who built the house walking by with her family. And she says, wait, that looks just like the house that was, you know, that my great, great grandfather built or whatever. And they end up moving the house out of the city because it's been overshadowed by the skyscrapers and the busyness and the subways and everything like that. And so it's just, you know, a beautiful little story. Similarly, Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel getting worked out of a job by the bigger, more powerful machines that can do more than he and his steam shovel can do. And he goes to this little town and digs the foundation out for their town hall. And, you know, then can't get out because he dug it so quickly. He didn't leave a space for him to get out. And so the deal was, you know, if he can do that in a single day, then they'll pay him. And if he can't do it in a single day, they won't pay him. And so I can't remember if it's the mayor or someone in power in the city is like kind of holding it over him, like, ah, he can't get out. There we go. And then some little boy just says, well, what if we just turn the steam shovel into the furnace for the city hall and he works the furnace and we pay him? And so again, there's this beautiful theme in both of the books of the kind of industrialization of our world and how it overcomes some things that are foundationally important to us and that we need to recover. And we need to preserve those things in whatever ways we can. So great themes there, very deep and rich themes. Again, very meticulous artwork. She illustrates them all herself. And you can see actually in the back of the book, there's kind of testimony from her kids who are like, she drew the same picture over 100 times to try to get it just right. So there's a kind of craft there that she brings to it that's really just excellent.
No, those are both great. For my money, and again, maybe this is just because I have no soul, but the Little House drags. I struggle with the Little House, but I love Mike Mulligan. And I think this is why. I think you're exactly right. They both deal with this the negative aspects of industrialization. But it feels like in Mike Mulligan, he's triumphant. Like he wins. And in The Little House, it feels like she's rescued and she's just sort of pulled out. But there's this feeling like she's now set up in the country again, but she was set up in the country at the beginning. Like, and the city will find her again. And that's so maybe that's why The Little House we've never kept around. But Mike Mulligan's great. I don't what does it say? He says, Mike always said that Marianne could dig as much in a day as 100 men could dig in a week. But he was never quite sure it was true.
That's right. That's right.
And I, for some reason, that detail I think is just masterful. Like it's this light touch where you're setting up this question: Can Marianne dig right as much in a day as 100 men could dig in a week? Mike Mulligan's not sure, and so like we've got to settle that question before the story's over. It's great, great. On the theme of houses, I'm going to introduce this one, but I'm more introducing the author. Herself. This is Elsa Besko, who I'd never encountered until the last couple of years. She's a Swedish author and illustrator whose works were translated into English. But the one that I've got here is Peter's Old House, which is one of our favorites. I have a boy named Peter. Peter features in a number of her books, and I have a Peter, and so you know we've done that. But in particular, Peter's Old House is lovely. It tells the story of this old man. In this little Swedish village who is, I don't know, he's the one everyone relies on. He was a sailor. They listen to his stories. He was a doctor. You know, he builds things. He fixes everything. He can do everything. And his own house is crumbling. And so eventually the authorities come and say, like, we're going to tear down your house because it's an eyesore. And then the town, but particularly the children of the town, rally around him. And, you know, the carpenter's son brings hammers and nails and wood. And the painter's son brings paints. And the mason's son brings bricks. But gradually their parents are involved and the whole town comes together to fix up his house. And then when the inspector comes, he's shocked and he has to leave. And so that it's a pleasant, light little story of village life. But the illustrations are really what sets it apart. They're vibrant. They're extremely colorful in kind of that Scandinavian style, or I guess the old Scandinavian style. Now just everything's bleak. But the old Scandinavian style of bright, vibrant colors. The illustrations are drawn, colored pencil style maybe. But we got a bunch of them. Peter's Old House is great. Peter and Blueberry Land is great. The Sun Egg is lovely. Children of the Forest, Woody Hazel, Little Pip. These are Princess Sylvie. Again, you don't go to them for plot, but you go to them for a picture of a beautiful world and a world that is harmonious and new how things ought to work. So gentle, pleasant stories. Elsa Besko, very, very good.
Well, my next book is kind of an introduction to an author as well. And I actually don't have that much breadth in this author. He's got quite the corpus, but Bill Peet is an excellent illustrator and has many, many books. I think maybe 20 or 30 books that are fairly lengthy, actually. Again, these are, you know, more like 15 minute reads as you nod along. They're great. We have a handful of them, and Megan grew up reading them more than I did, so she would be able to speak more to, you know, which ones are really excellent and which ones aren't. And if you have thoughts, let me know. But Kermit the Hermit is probably my favorite, and it's written in verse, which helps with the length. It kind of goes along in a good cadence. And the story is also really great because it's this hermit crab who hoards any shiny things that he can. And he just pulls the tin cans and the watches and the things like this into his cave in the bay. And eventually he goes off into the beach and tries to grab this can or something like that. And a dog comes over and is trying to bury him and get at him. And the boy who's with the dog comes over and shoos the dog away and saves him. And so he starts to think about that. He starts to ponder, you know, his kind of innate selfishness, his innate greed. And he thinks, I want to repay this boy somehow. And so long story short, it takes him on this adventure into the depths of the sea. He tries to help the boy catch a fish, and the fish rips the boy's fishing rod out of his hands, and it drags Kermit the Hermit with it down into the bottom of the ocean, where he, lo and behold, finds pirate treasure. But obviously it's a treasure chest and he's a crab. He can't carry it all back by himself all at once. So he has to make this dangerous journey through shark infested waters where there are big fish that eat crabs. And he takes it one coin at a time, one day at a time, and eventually fills his cave with this hoard and connects with, I think, a pelican maybe that kind of swoops down. And lo and behold, they fly over with the treasure little by little and drop it down the boy's chimney, and they find out you find out as the reader, I guess, he's very poor. They have almost nothing, and he repays this one kind deed with this life-changing deed, kind of puts his own neck out on the line for this boy who saves him. So Kermit the Hermit, Bill Peet in general. By the way, did you know that he did The Sword in the Stone for Disney? I didn't know that until last year, and I saw his name come up, and I'm like, I know who Bill Peet is now.
Yes, 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 yes. No, I think you're exactly right. I think he's involved in Robin Hood too. So I could be wrong about that one. But no, he did Sword in the Stone. That was great. No, I'm so glad to see Bill Peet on your list. Yeah, we've got a bunch of them. I can't recommend them highly enough. The only downside is they are so long.
Yes.
And you have to take that into consideration when you're saying yes. Like, all right, if I had a nickel for every time I've fallen asleep in a Bill Peet book, I'd have a couple of bucks probably. It's funny, Kermit the Hermit I actually haven't read, but I've heard other people who are Bill Peet aficionados say, like, that's the best one. My favorite's probably, it's tough. Cyrus the Unsinkable Sea Serpent, yep. Like, that might be tops on my list. Cowardly Clyde, though, that's a winner. The Wing Ding Dilly, another winner. The Caboose that Got Katie, the Caboose that Got Loose, That's a fun one. Chester the Worldly Pig.
Oh, it's great.
All these.
Chester the Worldly Pig is the first one that I read. And man, the length actually helps that so much because I read it for the first time as an adult, not knowing how it ends. It ends in a joke. And I won't say that here because you should go read it for yourself and spend 20 minutes building to the punchline. It's fantastic. And you don't get the same pleasure reading it again, but it is still a fun story to read.
You know, you're exactly right. The first time you read Chester, that's a winner. Okay, for my next one, though, I got to hit Frog and Toad. You can't leave Frog and Toad off. Again, one that I came to far too late in life, but that has paid dividends. This one, again, Peter loves Frog and Toad. But all of our kids have memorized Frog and Toad, probably. If your stomach is too sensitive for Winnie the Pooh, read Frog and Toad. And you get kind of that same, you get that same feel. And you read this and you're like, oh yeah, Toad is sinful the same way I am. Dang it. And so's Frog in a way. But you want to be like Frog. But they're both just people. And this the simplicity of the writing, this is one place where the simplicity of the writing strengthens it.
Yes.
And it is
actually,
it is still, it's excellent prose that is extremely simple. And like a very, very well done drawing. That is extremely simple. Like, wow, you managed to capture that emotion perfectly with three lines. How'd you do that? So yeah, Frog and Toad, we've got a massive collection of them and have read the cover off it. Yeah, so good.
Well, one of my last ones here is Crispin's Rainy Day by Forrest Dickinson. This book, I mean, it's made by Cannonball Books, the children's series from Cannon Press. And it's our favorite by far. I mean, it blew my doors off when I read it. The first time. I mean, the artwork is incredible. The story is great. And the verse is excellent. Like the meter, it carries the whole way through. And I've listened to him talk about it, not in person. Maybe you've heard him talk about it in person. I don't know. But he fashioned it very carefully so that it was easy to read and very familiar. I can't remember the tune that he was following, but he followed the cadence of a hymn. And so anyway, it's just excellent. So it starts with Crispin, this little boy, and his sister Rose. And, you know, Rose wants to have a picnic in the fort that she's built in the living room. And he kind of blows her off and runs out into the rain and jumps into a puddle into this magic world of pretend, right? He's there with his pirates and they're going to go find the lightning blade. And it starts full throttle, right? The pirates are all excited that their captain is back and that they can go on this journey. And then lo and behold, here comes Rose floating down from the sky with an umbrella, you know, pink dress and apron on, you know, ready to play along with her brother and have this, you know, picnic and try to kind of harmonize their ideas for games, which is, by the way, so crucial to help your kids understand how to do is to how to harmonize your ideas and play together. And you can combine your games and the things that you want to do. But still, he's blowing her off and, you know, he slams her into the captain's quarters that's just dirty and filthy and disgusting. So she's kind of cleaning it up and making this big pirate feast for them while he goes off and, you know, looks for the lightning blade in all of these dangerous places. And then they come in and he realizes the moment that one of the pirates sticks the cake that she's made, you know, into his mouth. He's outraged that she's prepared this lavish feast for them and wants to kind of get in the way. She's just a nuisance to him right now. But one of the pirates just sticks the fork of cake into his mouth. And it's like, he understands suddenly. It's like this visceral reaction, you know, wait a minute, my sister's important to me. And she's done something very kind. And she's engaged in this process of make-believe with us. So he walks out to apologize to her, and lo and behold, the dragon has taken her away and he has to go and save her. So just a phenomenal, phenomenal tying together of, like you've mentioned a few times here, the idea of sin and how it displays in our hearts and in our children's hearts and helping to give them some terminology, some archetypes maybe to follow. I love Rose because she's so steadfast in the midst of just getting beat down, you know, and just ignored totally and shut down at every turn by her brother. And she's just there steadfast, you know, standing in the face of this kind of bitterness and this anger. And that's what kind of wins him over. And then they crown her pirate queen, and it's great. Yeah, just phenomenal. I can't tell you how many times Levi and Ezra have jumped off the couch yelling, "For Rose!" with some kind of sword in their hand to slay the dragon, which is perfect now because we have a Rose too. We have Rosemary. So they actually get to say that and mean it. Yeah, just fantastic story.
Yeah, no, Christmas Rainy Day is phenomenal. You're exactly right. And of course, as you point out, near and dear to both of our hearts, as we have daughters named Rose. Funny story about that. I do know Forrest, he and I are friends, or at least pleasant acquaintances. We have kids in the same class at Logos and whatnot. But I had eagerly anticipated his book coming out. He's illustrated a bunch of books, but this is the first one he's written. And so I was like eager for it to come out. And they did like a reading and a book signing at the coffee shop. And I totally missed that it was happening, but happened to go the same day anyways. So like I took Salem and I'm like, why are there all these balloons? And why is Forrest here? And so we actually did get to go to his first reading of it, which was wonderful. Fun fact, maybe you talked about this elsewhere. Do you know he named all the pirates?
No, I didn't.
So all the pirates have names.
That's great.
Yeah. They're all sailors and explorers. So it's like Shackleton and Ferdinand what are the others? I forget. So Jacques and that sort of thing. So yeah, and what is maybe best about Crispin's Rainy Day, though, is that interplay of the masculine and the feminine, which is so hard to get. And you have girl stories and you have boy stories, typically. So from my list, Miss Susie is an example where you've got both, but that's not as potently as you have in Christmas Rainy Day, where you've got, you know, what should a woman of virtue do, and where does she fit into the story, and how should she compose herself in a story of high adventure, and what should the man of honor do, and you know, Crispin's realization that he's been seeking this prize and ignoring his crew, and that's his repentance there, is profound. But then it's only by seeking out to rescue Rose that he finds the lightning blade, and then he has to defeat the dragon, and it all comes together. So this interplay of the masculine and the feminine, if you can find books that do that well, grab them. And if you can write more, do that, please, and send
yeah, let us know, because we would love more of them. It really is so hard to do, and it's so hard to do in a way that is disarming for people who will resist it, and in a way, it may be impossible for many people, but in a way that is rich and meaningful and not just falling back into like easy kind of the tropes. I mean, he plays with that line here, but somehow strikes it where like, okay, it's the simplest thing, the oldest story in the world, that he's going to go and save his sister from the dragon. And yet he's added deeper meaning into that story because of everything that comes before. It's not just the dragon slaying quest. It's the dragon slaying quest that I kind of caused. And you know, there's,
yes. Yeah. Good.
You know, there's this interplay where he has set the stage for this through his own vice, and now has to redeem himself by saving his sister. You know, it's really incredible.
Okay, one last one for me. This is another Pilgrim's Progress. You can't beat Pilgrim's Progress. So we've had a number of adaptations. Dangerous Journey is the best. But second best for my money is Little Pilgrim's Big Journey. What I like best about this one is it does Christiana's journey rightly. So we were given two volumes. So you have Christian's journey and then Christiana's journey, and it's they're wonderful. The illustrations, I was a little bit at first I was a little put off by them because they're a little cartoony, and it came across slightly more. I just don't think they're stylistically as good, for one thing, as they could be, and also it came across in more of that, like, this is a book about a movie adaptation. It had that same sort of style, but the more time I spent with it, the more I realized, no, this is actually wonderful. And because it didn't stick with Bunyan's prose, it was able to cover much more of the Pilgrim's Progress. And so you got some of those stories from the Interpreter's House and some of the other side related people that he meets that maybe Dangerous Journey didn't have the space to go into. Little Pilgrim's Big Journey was able to do. And of course, it was able to do all of Christiana's journey, which, again, the masculine-feminine aspect, you need both. You need both. And we, Pilgrim's Progress is profitable for both genders, but you miss that corporate, that feminine aspect if you only read him on his quest. So Little Pilgrim's Big Journey and then Christiana's journey, both very, very good.
Well, my final book is a big change in tone. We mentioned it last week. One of my favorite books to read, just because it's so fun to read, is Fox and Socks, which we talked about last week very briefly. And you can't really talk about children's books in our day without at least mentioning Dr. Seuss, love him or hate him. You know, he's got several great books to read. Fox and Socks is my favorite by far. And I say that not as an uncritical, you know, Dr. Seuss reader. There are plenty of Dr. Seuss books that I don't like to read, but the nature of just all the tongue twisters and that it's a challenge and that it's something that as a parent, you want to try to get good at, you want to push yourself to read it faster without making any mistakes. And then, you know, you remember the day that you get through it for the first time without any slip ups and you feel like you've climbed Mount Everest. So it's fun, and I'm only imagining that it's going to be fun to have the kids try to read when they can read. I don't know if you've done that at all, but I'm imagining that, you know, when Levi can finally read, he's going to want to try to read it, and, you know, we can practice that together, which would be a good kind of twist. And I thought it would be worth mentioning just a couple of my favorite Dr. Seuss books other than this one, just to give you something to look for if you're trying to sort through the hundreds or, I don't know, however many there are. It would be, yeah, my favorites would be, other than Fox and Socks, Yertle the Turtle. It's a great one. It's got a great moral lesson about pride, being humbled, and, you know, not being a tyrant, not being wicked, and caring for others who are entrusted to you. The Cat in the Hat surprised me, because when I read it for the first time or two, I didn't really enjoy it, and now it's one of my favorites. And I just keep going back to it. I always read The Cat in the Hat willingly. And I think what it was is it took a little bit to get the cadence right, for me at least. It took a little bit to actually get in a good rhythm and pattern. So listening to somebody read it who does a good job is maybe helpful in that way. And this may be similar for Fox and Socks. It's helpful to hear somebody read it who's read it many, many times.
Yeah, no, I'm generally a Dr. Seuss guy, again, for the sake of the verse, and for the sake of teaching your kids to do fun things with words. I generally agree. Well, let me hit just a few honorable mentions before we have to sign off here. One that didn't make my list, but really probably should have, is Richard Scarry. You got to have Richard Scarry, you got to have Busy Town, again, in the contraption side of things. We've gotten a lot of mileage out of Richard Scarry. Tell Me DePaola's stuff is all very good. Jan Brett, we pick up pretty much every Jan Brett book we can find on the assumption that it's going to be great, and in the rare cases when it's you know, inane, we toss it. But her artwork is off the charts. Let's see. The Visitor for Bear, those books are excellent. Robert McCloskey's Make Way for Ducklings, The Biggest Bear, Blueberries for Sal, those are all very good. Any honorable mentions for you, sir?
I think one that I didn't really get into last week would be St. George and the Dragon. So this is kind of the companion to Sir Gareth by Trina Hyman-Schart. Her illustrations are wonderful. But yeah, St. George and the Dragon, excellent. That's my favorite edition of it that we've found, like favorite telling of the story that we've found so far. And then there's several, I don't have the publisher on hand, but there are several kinds of editions of these that you can find. We actually got one yesterday at McKay's. Anytime that you can find a kind of compilation of abridged or retold classics. So Mark Twain, The Prince and the Pauper, you know, Robin Hood, King Arthur. There are so many well-done illustrated versions of those stories. And obviously, you know, thumb through them, look through the pictures, maybe read through the stories ahead of time to make sure that, you know, they're at the level that you want for your kids, or that people aren't, you know, changing the story. Like you've mentioned, sometimes people change the story somewhat dramatically in ways that make the story worse, not better. So maybe just scan them in that way. But anytime you can find those sorts of classics, they are so helpful because, one, They're preparing them to read larger books. They're preparing them to read Robin Hood, to read King Arthur, to read, Mark Twain's novels. And they give them the kind of sense of the story, and they can look forward to it when they become readers. But two, they're giving them these common ideas that have shaped our culture. Black Beauty helped to shape our culture. And it's an essential story to our culture in some ways. So giving them some sense of those stories when they're still a little young to read them, or at least young enough that you can't read through all of them with any kind of speed, right? We can read Lord of the Rings over a year and a half, but we can't read Lord of the Rings over a year and a half while we also read Black Beauty and The Prince and the Pauper and Robin Hood, right? You can't do all of those things at once. So finding abbreviated editions of classics is a great, great way that we've found to incorporate some of those stories.
Yeah. No, that's right. That's good. Well, wrapping up here, just final word. You're always presenting your children with an interpretation of what the world is. You're always telling them what the world is and who God is. And you're telling them that with the stories you read them. And you're telling them that with the picture books that you give them. So our exhortation to you is just tell them the truth, and tell them the truth in as lovely a manner as you possibly can. Well, this whole podcast has been one big set of book recommendations, but hey, tradition dictates that we also do grown-up book recommendations as well. So, Mr. Winter, what's your book recommendation for us today on maybe a slightly less picture-y, book-y side of things?
Yeah, only slightly for me. It's still a children's book. It's My Side of the Mountain by Jean Craighead George. So she writes this book about a boy who essentially runs away from home and lives in the woods, and it captivated my imagination as a kid. I actually haven't read it since I was a kid. And yet it's one of those books that has stuck with me. And it's one of the kinds of books that makes you want to go play outside. It makes you want to try to catch fish in a river with a shoestring and, a Coke tab or something like that. And to test your fire making skills and to build a shelter, because he does all of these things and you follow him along in his journey. I mean, he trains a falcon, for crying out loud. And so it just captivates your imagination as a kid. It's a great book, a great story, and I'm imagining a great story to read to your kids. So I look forward to trying that out pretty soon. But yeah, My Side of the Mountain by Jean Craighead George.
Do you know how many hours I spent wandering around the woods looking for a big enough tree to carve myself a home out of?
Yes, probably as many as I did.
Probably as many as you did. that's great. No, that's a gem. And then my recommendation is Angels in the Architecture by Doug Wilson and Doug Jones. This is coming out a couple of years ago from Cannon Press. But this is a series of essays from these two Douglases trying to cast a vision for what they call medieval Protestantism, which my Catholic friend tells me is not a thing, but I disagree. And basically, the idea being we need to recapture a vision of the world, an integrated world, a world of beauty, and majesty and grandeur and goodness that was more rightly ordered to how God actually made the world. So those are essays for grown-ups, obviously. But I think that's exactly in line with what we were talking about in this episode for children, presenting the world in a beautiful, integrated fashion that's true to how God made it. So Angels in the Architecture by Doug Wilson and Doug Jones.
Interestingly, I am going to add this book to the list as well, even though these two aren't, picture books. There are many books that go by the title Angels in the Architecture by many different people, so make sure you get the right one.
That's great. Thank you. Yes.
Well, thank you for joining us. That's all the time we have for today. If you would like to follow what we've been writing about, you can see the link to our Substack in the show notes below. We want to say thank you as well to Shane Caver, who created the theme music for the show, and you can find link to his Spotify account as well. And with that, we hope you've been blessed and edified by the show.
Don't be hasty. Might have to call this one Pint with Treebeard, because I'm actually not drinking anything. And you're drinking LaCroix.